Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
How we shall laugh at the trouble of parting when we meet again.
With a state funeral in Toronto, friends, family, and the whole country bid a final farewell to former Finance Minister Jim Flaherty. We bring you full coverage of the ceremony and speak to his closest friends and colleagues.
The Prime Minister has announced that Canada is sending 6 fighter jets to Poland in response to the crisis in Ukraine. It comes as the U.S. announces a deal with Russia and Ukraine to de-escalate the situation. To address these developments, we're joined by McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petro and political editor Paul Wells.
The RCMP has announced it's dropping its investigation into Nigel Wright over that $90,000 check he wrote for Senator Mike Duffy. Rob Walsh, the former law clerk to the House of Commons, is here to tell us why there won't be criminal charges for the Prime Minister's former chief of staff.
Later, we'll speak with Yukon Premier Daryl Peslowski to discuss resource development. And we also take a look at the Harpleet data theft from the Canada Revenue Agency's website.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. With the sound of a single bagpipe, RCMP officers walked up the front steps of St. James Cathedral in Toronto, carrying the casket of Jim Flaherty, draped in the flag of the country he served for nearly 2 decades. That began the final farewell, as 800 people packed into the church for Wednesday's state funeral for the former finance minister who died suddenly at the age of 64.
Former Prime Ministers Brian Mulroney, Kim Campbell and John Turner, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair, Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, former Ontario Premier Mike Harris, and Toronto Mayor Rob Ford were just some of the dignitaries on hand to pay their final respects. Everyone attending was given a green scarf to wear to honour the Irish heritage that Flaherty was so proud of. The moving service brought a mixture of tears and laughter as Canada's political elite paid tribute to a man who exemplified public service.
It was a somber service, but it was also a celebration of Jim Flaherty's life. In one of the 3 eulogies, Prime Minister Stephen Harper honored Flaherty's political achievements and tapped into the self-deprecating humor that Flaherty was well known for.
It is a fact that Jim, as fiercely partisan as he was, and he was also genuinely liked and respected by his opponents. Liked by his enemies. That's something in this business. Something I envy. I can't even get my friends to like me.
But the Prime Minister got emotional as he ended his speech recalling his last conversation with Flaherty after Flaherty decided to resign from Cabinet on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day.
And I told Jim that he had truly been, over these 8 years, in my judgment, the best finance minister in the world, if not indeed the best in our history. I also wished him well in his next career, and I told him not to be a stranger. Friends, I don't want you to misunderstand me. I do not grieve for Jim Flaherty. I know that for Jim, the Lord has prepared a place where he can be free from the afflictions of recent times, loved, and enjoy. Know, my friends, when a good one leaves us, our grief is for those who are left behind. So, one more word for those, and this time specifically for John, Galen, and Quinn, the boys, as your father always called you. Let me just say this, as I told you yesterday. I lost my own father almost exactly 11 years ago to the day. From that period, I remember almost nothing of what I said or what was said to me. So powerful were the waves of emotion. But once that passed and perspective took hold, I came to appreciate my father's place in my life probably even more fully and deeply than if he were still here. And it is all good, and it will be all good for you.
Flaherty's family members also shared their stories. His sister Nora praised his work to help the disabled.
Both Jimmy and I have sons with different abilities. I know that when Jimmy and Christine were breaking ground for the Ability Center in Whitby, Jimmy had tears in his eyes. Their dream had come true. to build a center where people of all abilities could gather. The Ability Center has improved the lives of so many and will continue to do so. We are so proud of Jimmy. As Jimmy would say, live in the moment, pursue your passions, and open your hearts.
Galen, one of his triplet sons, told the crowd of mourners that this is not the end of his relationship with his dad.
It really is. It's just the beginning. I feel him today more than I've ever felt him. I've got his voice permanently stuck in my head, and right now he's telling me to wrap it up, by the way, so I will. My father, he was a politician because he loved his country. He was my dad because he somehow won my mom. I'm not sure. She looks beautiful today, by the way, everyone. But at the end of the day, he was my father because he showed me what it takes to be a man. And he gave me an example that I will aspire to for the rest of my life.
Quinn, another of Flaherty's sons, describes how his father taught him about the most important values in life.
Four things that our family is blessed to have, and four things that I personally pray for every night. Friendship, family, faith, and love. Dad, I love you. We love you. Put your feet up. Lay your head back, close your eyes, and relax. We will take it from here.
Jim Flaherty's wife, Ontario MPP Christine Elliott, was the last to eulogize her husband. She ended the tribute with a message of comfort.
I know that you're all mourning Jim's loss with us and feel very sad and empty. Jim would never, ever want you to feel that way. I'd like to close with an anonymous Irish eulogy that has brought us tremendous comfort, and I hope that will help you too. Death is nothing at all. It does not count. I have only slipped away into the next room. Everything remains as it was. The old life that we lived so fondly together is untouched, unchanged. Whatever we were to each other, that we are still. Call me by the old familiar name. Speak of me in the easy way which you always used. Put no sorrow in your tone. Laugh as we always laughed at the little jokes we enjoyed together. Play, smile, think of me, pray for me. Let my name be ever the household word that it always was. Let it be spoken without effort. Life means all that it ever meant. It is the same as it always was. There is unbroken continuity. Why should I be out of mind because I am out of sight? I am but waiting for you, for an interval, somewhere very near, just around the corner. All is well. Nothing is hurt. Nothing is lost. One brief moment, and all will be as it was before. How we shall laugh at the trouble of parting when we meet again.
The bells tolled as Flaherty's casket was carried out of the church, with a police honor guard standing at attention and saluting the former finance minister.
After the ceremony, his friends and colleagues shared their thoughts. Justice Minister Peter McKay was happy there was a lot of laughter because it proved Flaherty's bright spirit could still shine through on such a sad day.
You know, there was a certain magic of humor that Jim brought to everything he did, even in the most dire circumstances. He always had a grin and had great wisdom and insight, but he did it with class. He was always there as such a solid and thoughtful person, and he looked at life with a certain Irish wit that shines through, and we're going to miss him gravely. He was a great friend who I loved. He was a great man.
The last state funeral in Canada was in 2011 for the late NDP leader Jack Layton. His widow, Olivia Chow, paid her respects to Flaherty and gave his family a message of strength.
Cherish every moment because and carry on Jim Flaherty's legacy, because this is what it's about. Even though a person is gone, the spirit carries on. And I've no doubt Christine is going to do the same. It's going to be very difficult times, but she has very close family and friends. In fact, entire country with love surrounding her, so I just wish her strength.
Now, for members of Parliament, it will be difficult to get back to business in the House of Commons after such a big loss. But Transport Minister Lisa Raitt says it's what Jim would have wanted.
He really would have been kicking our butts and saying, back to work. Time to go back to work. Time to get things done. The country doesn't wait. The economy doesn't stop. You got to keep going.
Coming up, the Maclean's panel looks at the latest developments in Ukraine, and we try to find out why the RCMP has dropped its investigation into the Prime Minister's former chief of staff, Nigel Wright.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we talk about a major development in the Senate expense scandal, and we take a look at privacy concerns after social insurance numbers were stolen from the Canada Revenue Agency's website.
But first, Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced on Thursday that Canada is sending six CF-18 fighter jets to Poland as part of a NATO air policing mission in response to the crisis in Ukraine.
And frankly, more generally, the concern that we have on what really is expansionism and militarism on the part of Russia under the presidency of Mr. Putin.
The Canadian fighter jets will join warplanes from the United States, Britain, Denmark, Poland, Portugal, and Germany, which will be deploying in waves between now and the fall.
The announcement came on the same day the U.S. and European Union brokered a deal between Ukrainian and Russian officials to halt the violence that's been escalating in eastern Ukraine. To delve deeper into this topic, it's now time for the Maclean's panel, and I'm joined by Maclean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru and political editor Paul Wells. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So these are some big developments with the crisis in Ukraine. Michael, you were there at the start when Russia decided to invade Crimea. What do you make of the action of Canada sending planes over to Poland as well as this deal struck with the U.S.?
Well, I think Canada's dispatching the F-18s to Poland is meant to reassure our NATO allies that have been asking for this sort of support. They feel exposed. I know some Eastern members of the NATO alliance feel that those of us that are not as directly threatened by Russia have been somewhat neglectful, and I think this is meant to reassure those allies. Regarding the deal struck today, it's very curious. This is supposed to de-escalate the situation in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian militants have taken control of several key installations across the east. What is curious about it is the deal, of course, was struck with Russia, but Russia claims that these militants are acting solely on their own, they are a grassroots movement, and that any allegations of Russian involvement, and especially military involvement in eastern Ukraine, is nonsense. So it's curious how Russia could guarantee the de-escalation, could vouch for these people leaving their bases, as they're now expected to do, if they have nothing to do with the unrest in the first place.
So, Paul Wells, you will be heading over to Europe soon. And I think Canadians who are looking at the situation may be a little bit confused. They see, on one hand, a deal struck to try and de-escalate, as Michael pointed out, but then also we're sending planes over. CF-18s. Yep. So they may see it as something that would actually escalate the situation or increase the tensions.
Ronald Reagan used to quote an old Russian saying, and I have no idea whether this is actually an old Russian saying. He used to say, trust but verify. It's great if you've got a deal with the Russian foreign minister, but in the meantime, there are facts on the ground. And as Michael said, it's a curious situation when the Russians have essentially promised to stop doing what they had just insisted they weren't doing. And so a couple things need doing. First of all, the most significant component of the accord between the Russians and the Americans and the Europeans and the Ukrainians is this notion that the OSCE would get to send in observers into Eastern Europe within coming days, probably already on the way as we speak. That's handy because at least those observers can report on the situation that they find. And then the other thing is NATO is an alliance of 70 years standing that exists for one purpose, which is to protect Russia. It was to protect Europe against any temptation Russia might have towards expansionism. And NATO has been distracted by the Afghan war, and it has fallen a little bit into disarray, both by American retrenchment and by European financial crises. And it's time to do some repairs, just like we do on bridges in Montreal, to do some repairs to the NATO alliance. More frequent exercises together, more frequent cross deployments, the sort of stuff that we did during the Cold War, until we're absolutely sure that this guy Putin has changed his mind about the way he behaves. We have to use NATO for what it was originally built to do, which is to protect Europe.
Can we even trust Putin at this point? I mean, he's already basically lied about what he was doing in Crimea.
Well, yes, let's review the record. And let's start a little bit further back. Let's start in 1994 when Russia signed a treaty guaranteeing and protecting, promising to protect the sovereignty of Ukraine under its current borders. Russia's invasion and then annexation of Crimea, part of Ukraine, was a blatant violation of a solemn treaty between superpowers. That changed everything in terms of the worth of other treaties that Russia has signed, in terms of Putin's own credibility as an individual. That was massive. And then, of course, we have the complete disaster of Crimea, where Putin swore up and down that the well-armed, well-coordinated men flying in their hundreds onto airports seized by these troops in Crimea were not Russian. He promised this, he insisted on this, and then just recently he has said that, in fact, when the alleged referendum or so-called referendum regarding Crimea's future status was taking place, that Russian troops were there, as he put it, at the backs of the Ukrainian pro-Russian militants. So, I mean, Putin has lied repeatedly in the past weeks, and he has already broken a solemn treaty that Russia signed in 1994. So I think his credibility regarding what Russia may or may not do in eastern Ukraine in the weeks ahead is very much weak.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Maclean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru and Maclean's political editor Paul Wells. We're discussing the latest developments on the situation in Ukraine. And I just have another question for you guys. With this military action being taken now and sending some officers over as well as some CF-18s, is this just flexing muscles, or do you think NATO would be ready to punch if it had to?
It's funny that even the Obama administration, which is the most pacifist U.S. Administration in probably since Jimmy Carter's, has been saying clearly that Article 5 of the NATO treaty requires, the North Atlantic Treaty, requires that an attack on any member state be responded as an attack on all member states and be rebutted by all member states. So even the Obama administration doesn't see this as empty gestures. If Putin were ever foolish enough to attack Estonia or Lithuania or Poland, he could expect to be at war with all of the NATO member states, including us. I think we're still quite a distance short of that. I think Putin is essentially trying to see what he can get for free. I mean, we're sending F-18 jet fighters. He's sending guys in balaclavas to cut down trees and block highways. It's a strikingly asymmetrical conflict at this point, and I suspect that if the Ukrainians first of all send a really strong force on the ground to stand up to this, he'd stop pushing. I think he's essentially seeing what freebies are available.
And Michael, your take on this? You being on the ground at one point during this crisis, what's your take on this?
I think if NATO and NATO members are not ready to punch, as you put it, then we are honor-bound to disband the organization, to disband the alliance. NATO is not the European Union. It is not an economic organization. It's not a political organization. It's not something that is offered to developing democracies as a way to get them to change their political systems. It is a mutual defense organization. It exists to protect its members. I think that is very important in this context when we consider what Russia might do to NATO members, such as the Baltic states, of course. I think it also is wise for us to remember that as we consider extending NATO membership, to remember that extending that membership imposes a responsibility on the existing members that they must be willing to defend any new members that are brought into the alliance.
Thank you very much, Maclean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru and Maclean's political editor Paul Wells.
There has been a major development in the Senate expense scandal. The RCMP has announced that it is dropping its investigation into Nigel Wright, the former chief of staff to Prime Minister Stephen Harper. The Mounties began their probe in June of last year after news broke that Wright had given Conservative Senator Mike Duffy a $90,000 check. Wright maintains he only wanted to reimburse the taxpayers for Duffy's inappropriately claimed living allowances. To break down why Nigel Wright is not facing charges in this case, I'm joined now by Rob Walsh, a former law clerk of the House of Commons. So, Rob, I know that when you had looked at this case, you had wondered whether it met the burden for a criminal charge. So I take it you're not terribly surprised with the announcement this week that the RCMP is not going to pursue charges against Nigel Wright.
No, I can't say I'm surprised. I suppose I should admit that I'm relieved not to find myself contradicted. But no, I'm not surprised. I just did not see the basis for a criminal charge in the facts set out by Corporal Horton in his IPO affidavit last November.
Why is that? Is it just that it didn't seem like Mr. Wright had anything to gain from the $90,000 check?
My analysis begins with the larger consideration, which is essentially that in respect of criminal offenses, one does need to find a criminal intent, and typically a criminal intent, broadly speaking, is something that is not simply unlawful by the terms of the wording of a criminal code provision, but which also reflects an immoral or corrupt intention, particularly in the case of fraud and breach of trust. And I did not see in what was recounted regarding Wright and Duffy that Mr. Wright's actions reflected a corrupt intent, that is to say, an intent to advance his own interests, to bend the rules or conceal facts in such a way as to bring a benefit to himself.
On the other hand, you had also referenced the Parliament of Canada Act and this idea that Section 16 of the Parliament of Canada Act relating to senators not accepting money, that could possibly be applied here. It would seem that the RCMP either, I guess we don't know exactly what happened, but obviously they decided not to go forward with any charges in that regard. Do you think that is something that should have been considered or may have applied here?
Well, I don't know that I can say it should have been considered in the sense that I don't know that it wasn't considered. I don't know that it was considered. It seems to me, from reading Section 16, it would seem applicable to the actions of both Mr. Wright and Mr. Duffy. Whether the evidence was found by the RCMP to support a charge under Section 16, I can't say. But it is broader in its terms than any of the sections to which the RCMP was looking in the criminal code. So I would have thought that the prospects of finding a basis for a charge under Section 16 would be there. And I don't know why it is. I frankly am at a loss to understand why it is that this section has not been mentioned as a possible section to apply. I mean, in Corporal Horton's affidavit in November, there's no mention of this section that I can recall seeing. And in the recent statement by the RCMP, there's a reference to the Parliament of Canada Act, but not to protect Section 16, but they end up saying there's no basis for criminal charges, which suggests that that doesn't take into account what might be available under Section 16. So I can't explain it. I don't know why it is that Section 16 seems to have been overlooked. But then I also understand Section 16 is not for the Ontario Crown Council people to deal with, but rather the federal special prosecutor, or whatever he's called, PPSC or something, that new prosecuting authority at the federal level would have responsibility, I think, for Section 16, and they don't appear to have taken any active interest in it.
Is it possible that just the fact that, as I understand it, that section of the act is basically unprecedented for anyone to be pursued on that, in those regards? Is that, you know, is it just unlikely that it would ever be used?
Well, it's my understanding that, as far as we know, it hasn't been used. I understand from those who have done the research, I have not myself, but I understand from those who have done the research that there is no jurisprudence to be found under Section 16, that is to say, court cases making a determination under Section 16. Now, whether there were other cases that didn't come to a judicial ruling, I don't know, but it be that as it may, the language is fairly straightforward, and it either provides a basis for a charge or it doesn't, and much of the criminal code provisions can be looked at in the same way. So, again, I don't know why it is that Section 16 wasn't considered.
In the abstract, we have a situation here where the chief of staff of the prime minister is known to have given money to a sitting legislator. And I suspect that a lot of people would just sort of look at that and reflexively say, well, that shouldn't be something that's happening, or there's something not quite right about that. Is that, in that regard, does there need to be a law that explicitly outlines this? Do we need to find some way to deal with a situation like this?
Well, it seems to me we have that law, frankly, in Section 16. First of all, there could be certain circumstances where money is given to a parliamentarian for bona fide reasons that should not cause any concern, whether it's giving them $50 to pay for a traffic ticket or giving him $90,000 to meet some obligation on his house. It could well be done for other personal considerations that has nothing to do with the parliamentarian's duties. However, admittedly, as the amount gets up to such numbers as $90,000, eyebrows raise and questions are asked. It's not nearly as innocent as a $50 for paying for a parking ticket. So do we need laws to deal with this? Well, we have the law in Section 16, which prohibits the giving of any kind of benefit to a senator for the purpose of influencing or attempting to influence the senator. So, you know, unless it's an innocent payment that can be readily explained, the only other alternative is that it's a payment of a kind designed to influence the senator. Well, influence the senator in what respect? Well, it would appear from Section 16 it could be in respect of a controversy. I mean, the language is quite broad. You know, I think we have the law in Section 16 to address what you're describing, and I don't know why it is that it wasn't brought into play.
Do we get into any kind of an odd situation, though, where we're having to figure out, you know, again, as you said, $50 for a parking ticket or $90,000 for a housing allowance? You know, cabinet appointments are handed out. That conceivably is a benefit to someone. You know, like, there's all sorts of things that happen in politics that are relatively accepted that may, you know, add some advantage to someone. Do we get into an odd situation where it's hard to legislate for these sorts of things?
Well, yes. Let's not be naive here. I think it is the case that in the political world, sitting parliamentarians could be influenced in their behavior by promises of future consideration, to use that term from another context. And then later, that consideration arises and a beneficial appointment is made of some kind. You never can trace that. You can't find that. You can't prove that. You can't, you know, so in a sense, there's a limit to what the law can do when you get into the realm of politics. Of course, members of parliament and senators don't exercise their parliamentary function of debate and voting free of any influence unrelated to what they're voting about. So there could be a particular group of constituents who threaten to cause the member to lose his riding, and the member changes his position and doesn't do what he thinks he should do because he's afraid of losing his riding. Or it could be that there's a prospect of an appointment of some kind from the government, and so the member curtails his views so as to not offend the government. I mean, you can go on and find a number of circumstances where members of parliament or senators will allow their views to be compromised for the sake of some other consideration, which arguably should not be at play. But it is. And the Section 16, I think, in the Parliament of Canada Act relating to the Senate, and the corresponding section for the House of Commons is Section 41, I think it is, in the Parliament of Canada Act. These provisions really are meant to say, stay out of our business. I mean, short of bribery, which is a straightforward offense, and that's in the criminal code, this means to say, you may not be giving money to our senator for some personal benefit, but if you're giving him money or some other benefit so as to influence his judgment, then, you know, we don't want you to do that. And there's a penalty for that. I mean, we hear this about American politics, where you have large lobby groups or commercial lobby groups, or you have the PAC, so-called Parliament Political Action Committees. And they are huge financial players, and clearly no one questions the fact that they have an influence on how the American congressman carries out his function. But they're legitimate. That's part of the political process. So here, you know, money talks in Canada as well, although not perhaps as loudly as the United States. But money talks here, and money comes in many different forms. Benefits come in many different forms. And so it is that you could have members of Parliament and senators alike influenced in the exercise of their judgment or the performance of their duties by the prospect of certain possible benefits coming their way. And as I say, 16 and 41 are designed to basically say to people out there, you may not be bribing anybody, but at the same time, don't try influence our process by throwing in and offering benefits to our parliamentarians so as to impair or to alter their course of action.
So, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but would you have pursued something on...
Sorry?
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but would you have used Section 16 in this situation?
Would I have used Section 16?
Yes.
I would certainly have looked at the evidence that was developed in the light of Section 16, yes. Whether I would find the evidence sufficient to warrant proceedings under Section 16, I can't say, because I haven't had to look at all the evidence. But to go back to Corporal Horton's affidavit of last November, it would seem to me that prima facie, there's a basis for charges under Section 16 based on what he said.
That's Rob Walsh, the former law clerk of the House of Commons. Wright's case has been referred back to the Ethics Commissioner, and the RCMP will reportedly make a decision in the next few weeks on whether or not to charge Senator Mike Duffy.
Coming up, we have a sit-down interview with the Yukon Premier, and we look at the theft of social insurance numbers from the Canada Revenue Agency's website. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
On Monday, we found out around 900 taxpayers had their social insurance numbers stolen from the Canada Revenue website thanks to the Heartbleed bug. This has raised a lot of criticism that the government is not doing enough to protect your private information. Raymond Van Crimpen is a risk management specialist and a partner with the firm Richter. He tells me there are a lot of risks for Canadians.
The Heartbleed vulnerability has been around for 2 years. Whether or not anybody's known about it and has been able to exploit it for the past 2 years is a big question mark. And people in the security area are going to be monitoring things closely to see just how much damage that this particular vulnerability has posed.
If the CRA's website was vulnerable to this, does this mean that other government websites and the CRA in the future could be vulnerable again to all of this?
To this particular vulnerability, no. But other ones, absolutely. And it's a constant cat and mouse game with the security flaws, vulnerabilities, and the hackers out there that are wanting to take advantage of these things for nefarious purposes. So, yeah, it's absolutely possible.
So is identity theft the only crime that could really happen based on these social insurance numbers being taken, or are there other risks for Canadians who may have had their sins taken?
Well, identity theft is the main one, and it's what happens after the identity is stolen that is the real issue. So once your identity has been stolen, you know, all sorts of credit services could be made under different aliases. Your credit score will be damaged and take a long time to sort through that. It's a real hassle. So that's, you know, that's kind of the extent of the damage there.
What can listeners do right now to protect themselves and their identity from this kind of theft in the future?
It's mostly preventative in nature right now. I mean, if you're going to do stuff that's preventative, you're going to do things like keep a strong password, change your password periodically. So pay heedance to that advice. Be careful about how much information you put online. If an identity thief is looking to build up a identity based on your personal information, they'll be able to scrape it very easily off the internet if you put too much stuff on there. So check your privacy settings on things like your Facebook accounts and other social media outlets that you might be involved with. So those two things from a preventative nature. Now on the detective side, certainly taking a look at your credit reports on a periodic basis is a good idea. So, you know, I myself take a look at it once or twice a year at least. And if you're really, really concerned, then subscribe yourself to one of the credit monitoring services that are available by the credit reporting agencies.
A 19-year-old computer science student has been arrested and charged in relation to this data theft, although none of the allegations have been proven in court. To listen to the full interview with Van Crimpen, go to mcleans.ca.
One of the most controversial issues in Canadian politics these days is how to approve or reject major resource projects, especially when it comes to First Nations and environmental concerns. But the Yukon might be quietly ahead of the curve. For a decade, under federal law, the territory has had a unique process for assessing resource projects. That groundbreaking approach is now up for review. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sat down with Yukon Premier Daryl Peslowski to talk about it. Premier, thanks for taking some time to talk to us today. I appreciate it. I wanted to ask you first about the Yukon Environmental and Socioeconomic Assessment Board. And the reason I was hoping to start with that is because there's so much interest across Canada now in coming up with a coherent, understandable way of doing all the different elements of assessing big resource projects. It's an issue everywhere from Ontario's Ring of Fire area to pipeline projects in northern BC. Here you've got a model. Can you tell us a bit about how it works and how well you think it's working?
Well, you know, truly where this began was it's really part of the process of the agreements that we have with First Nations and in part of their final self-government agreements, and we evolving how governance in the Yukon worked was the creation of YESA, Yukon Environmental Social Economic Assessment Act. And it truly was groundbreaking in Canada at the time. It's a little over a decade old now. And it was the opportunity to have one project, one assessment. And what it also afforded was to put some timelines to this process. It was the utilization of both scientific and traditional knowledge, and that was fully transparent in the fact that all Yukoners would be able to log on online. You can see all the projects. You can provide comments as you want. So it has really been something that the rest of the country looked at, and we've seen evolution in the last few years towards a similar type of a model.
How long does it typically take? You talk about timelines to assess a project under the YESA formula.
Yeah, and another comment is that what we are assessing is the environmental impacts, but also the social and the economic impacts as well. And I think that that's very important. And how long it takes really depends upon what type of project it is. Certainly you can have a large mining project will take considerably longer than, you know, somebody who's making minor adjustments, or, you know, a small project can take literally just a short period of time. So it can extend up to even 2 years on large projects.
Wow. And I'll talk to some First Nations leaders about this, but from your perspective, how well does it integrate your First Nations here in the Yukon into this, you know, thinking about economic development?
Well, through the agreements, the umbrella final agreement, this board was created with the representation of from Canada, representation from the Yukon government, and representation from Yukon First Nations. So that's what comprises the executive committee. And we have many different committees that have been created as a result of the umbrella final agreement. The Waters Act is done through the Water Board, again with representation from all tripartite. and also such things as fish and wildlife management as well, resource councils within the different areas around the territory. So what we've seen through the evolution of final self-government agreements with First Nations, this integration of all of these types of input that is there and is a part of how we do business now in Yukon.
So broadly speaking, after a decade of experience with this model, and I'm sure it's evolved over the years, if you were talking to people elsewhere in Canada who might be right now throwing up their hands and saying environmental concerns, First Nations concerns, other types of concerns, it's too difficult, it's maybe an unsolvable problem to get some kind of social consensus around big resource projects, especially in areas where there's real concern about the environment. What do you say? Do you think you've got a positive answer for them? Is there a way to think about this stuff as being less of an intransigent problem than maybe we sometimes think of it as being?
Well, I think first off, with YESSA, there hasn't been an evolution because it's federal legislation, and what we're in a process right now, because over a decade you do start to see opportunities or areas where perhaps there's a need to make some amendments, and we're going through that process right now with the federal government and with the First Nations to try to streamline, to really address some of the areas where the first attempt at this looks like it could use some improvement. What I would say is that when you can bring everybody together through a process like this, it's very beneficial, and that's why I think we're seeing those attempts happening in the other parts of the country.
I'll move away from this in a sec, but can you give me just a sense of what kinds of improvements you think are necessary? Are these technical matters, or are there sort of fundamental changes that need to happen?
Well, I think everybody has provided recommendations. I think there is some areas, because it's federal legislation, I think the opportunity to have a little more control at the territorial level would be beneficial. Certainly, Yukon has prospered in the 10 years since we've gone through our devolution, something that Northwest Territories is just beginning right now. So anytime that you can allow decisions to be made at the local level, I think you can get better decisions occurring. But there is some work in terms of adequacy. We've identified continued work in all aspects of the process for timelines is another area. There's regional offices throughout the territory. We think there's an opportunity to have a little more consistency between each office as well. So this is fine-tuning is what it is, really. But in terms of an ability, I think what you see is First Nations and Yukons as a whole want to see continued progress. We want to continue to build our economy. This is a process by which we can assure that we are identifying all those issues that need to be considered. And at the end, this process comes up with some recommendations and perhaps some mitigating factors around a project. And then, so that's an opportunity then to see issues are addressed while still seeing projects move
just
forward.
A last question. So you're talking about amending the federal legislation. Any idea on when you might be at a stage to actually see that happen?
Well, the federal government is in the process right now. They have some draft legislation that's right now is they are consulting with industry, with First Nations, with the government. So we are in the process of providing comments on that. That's due before the end of this month. We're hopeful that it will be in the very near future that the federal government will table those amendments to the legislation and then the subsequent work on the regulations as well.
That's McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Yukon Premier Daryl Puslowski. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.